Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Most people don't know the name Anne Wollstonecraft. She was a botanist in Cuba in the 19th century, and she was one of the first to document many of the plants native to the island country. Recently, scientists rediscovered the botany book where she documented her findings, nearly 200 years after it was written. It was detailed drawings and observations of plants native to Cuba during the 19th century. I spoke with Zerny Reed, a lecturer at the University of Florida and a freelancer for National Geographic. She explained the importance of the book in Cuba's scientific history. For someone who's not that into plants, what is it that makes this particular book so important?
You don't have to be into plants at all to find this book really fascinating. It was described by Cuban botanist Miguel Esquivel as a jewel of Cuban literature. The drawings are exquisite. It is so well preserved after almost 200 years. And there are so many details of indigenous uses of the plants that are in the manuscript, of personal observations written by the author. There's even some poetry there. So I think it's really quite interesting for anyone who is interested in science and art and sort of the intersection of those.
Can you describe to us a little bit, just to give us a visual of what the drawings that she partook in, like what they actually look like on the page?
They look like flowers. And it's vivid color. There are reds and greens and purples and whites. Even the white on the paper, it's dark. It's really dramatic. It's just really exquisite is a word I keep using. But it's like the pages are blooming. And it's interesting because for something that's 200 years old, almost, you wonder, how is it so well preserved? And we'll know that from that time when she was doing this, the paper that was in use would have been rag-based paper as opposed to the wood-based paper that we mostly use now. So that rag-based paper was much more durable than, say, our newspaper, which, you know, starts crumbling after a few days. And then the inks that she used, they were so vibrant. So she used also very high-quality inks to help preserve all of that.
And Wollstonecraft was, from what I understand and what you've written, really an amateur. She wasn't formally trained in this, but she was just really drawn into the natural world. What did that do for you looking into this and learning about her going through that process?
You know, this is a story about women in STEM as well. So she was largely self-taught. She mentions that she didn't consult with any botanists and she didn't get any help. So for someone with that background, sort of at the intersection of art and science, I think this is important from that perspective. It's a story about women in a field where they were underrepresented. Ladies of that time who were well brought up were probably taught how to draw and paint and so on. And so what is interesting is that she chose to use that skill, that training that she had, and rather than drawing, I don't know, things about fashion or other things, she chose to focus on science. So maybe that was her way of really making her mark and staking her position in the field.
And women have long been overlooked when it comes to their role in STEM. That's science, tech, engineering, and mathematics. And if it's a problem in 2019, it was definitely a problem in the early 1800s. So I really want to highlight that it's a woman that we're talking about here. It's Anne Wollstonecraft. Who was she and what do we know about her and her biography?
So she was likely a woman of some means, given her family name and history and connections. I think we can perhaps surmise that she was able to use some of those resources and connections to get access to, you know, existing botanical manuscripts and botanical texts of the time. In a biography that was found by Judith Russell on a genealogy website, they mentioned that she was living in Cuba and amusing herself by drawing plants. So that was people's sort of description of what she was doing. So here she was engaged in this highly scientific pursuits, but it was seen as a woman amusing herself.
It almost sounds like she's like an Emily Dickinson of science, if you will, that she was kind of laboring at this on her own. Then only afterwards, years later, her work was discovered and said, oh, this wasn't just scribblings. This is actually a work of art.
Right. And in 1828, when it first came to the attention of folks in the U.S., I think there was some intention to try to get the manuscript published, but there was a lack of funds. And there was one mention that the New York Horticultural Society was trying to collect enough funds to publish it. And I don't know if her death was what put an end to that, or whether they just didn't get the funds to publish it. And so then it just wasn't published at all. I know that Emilio Cueto, he wants to see her take her rightful place as an artist and as a scientist. And so his goal is to have the manuscript translated to Spanish so it can be more widely accessible to not just English speakers, but Spanish speakers. And he wants to see her exhibited in D.C. at the National Museum of Women in the Arts, wow, where it could be seen by millions who, you know, traverse the nation's capital. So if we leave it to Emilio Cueto, she's not done yet. She will find her rightful place in science and the arts.
I'm speaking with Zerny Reed. She's a science writer and a lecturer at the University of Florida College of Medicine. She recently reported on a story for National Geographic about an old botany book that was lost in history. The book was discovered by scientists after 190 years. It has detailed drawings and observations of plants native to Cuba during the 19th century. When you were reporting this story and going through it, did you talk to any botanists directly about this? I understand it was kind of a mythical text in the world of Cuban botany and science and research.
Right. So I talked with Cuban botanist Miguel Esquivel, who is in Cuba, and who was actually collaborating with Emilio Cueto, who is a very important part of this story. In fact, without Emilio, this story would not have come to light at this point. And so Dr. Esquivel is working with Emilio to sort of assess the material in the book and see whether things were accurate, and then trying to place them and characterize them in the context of the scientific knowledge of the time.
And you mentioned the researcher Emilio Cueto. What role did he play in really the rediscovery of this text and how you came to find it, and how now more of the world is learning about it?
Right. So if this is a detective story, then Emilio is the chief detective here. And so I found out about this story in October of 2018. I happened to be in a meeting with Judith Russell, who is the Dean of Libraries at the University of Florida. She had just come back from a trip to Ithaca to visit the Cornell Libraries with Emilio Cueto.
Ithaca, New York, in upstate New York?
Right, in upstate New York to look at this manuscript. And so she was telling me about this trip that she'd just come back from. And then she pulls out her iPad and starts showing me these pictures that she took of this exquisite work. And it was really just, like I said, I found it fascinating. And the story was quite infectious. Emilio started looking for this book, this manuscript, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. He is a self-described collector of all things Cuban, and he has put on a number of exhibits. He has put on a ceramics exhibit. He's done an exhibit at the History of Miami Museum on Cuban flora and fauna. And while he was putting together an exhibit and doing his research, he came across historical mentions of this manuscript. He couldn't find it. It was just, you know, little references. And so when he was putting together the catalog for his own, when Emilio was putting together the catalog for his own exhibit, he did what those other historians and journalists and so on had done. He mentioned this book, Sight Unseen. He just did not want it to get lost. He knew it was out there, and he wanted somebody coming after him to look in his work and say, oh, wow, Emilio Cueto mentioned this, you know, in 2002, so we should look for it. So he had been looking for this book, and he probably searched for it in online catalogs for, I don't know, 100 times or more. He can't remember how many times and, you know, what permutations or combinations of words he searched for, you know, words and phrases. But this one time in March 2018, it comes into his head. He types something in the World Catalog, which is just this global catalog of works, you know, from everywhere. And he types something in, and the work comes up. It was spelled a little incorrectly, but he knew what he had found. And, you know, I describe it as his Archimedes moment. You know, it's like, I found it. So he said, yeah, this is the woman. This is the woman I've been looking for. This is the woman that everybody's been looking for.
Zarni, what was the significance of really the right researchers at the right time using investigative tools to look for something as mythical and legendary as this, and then finally finding it? Like, what was the importance of actually locating something like this?
So Dr. Esquivel, in the Cuban botanist, he describes this as one of the greatest finds of its time, in modern time, so the second half of the 19th century and the 20th century. So the period around which this woman was working it was a time of great naturalist exploration in Cuba. In fact, there were many European naturalists who came and were, examining and cataloging the botany of Cuba. One potential that it holds is for ethnobotanists and ethnopharmacologists, because it talks so much about indigenous uses of all these plants. So in ethnobotany, researchers will take clues and hints from indigenous uses of plants and then try to come up with modern medicines or modern pharmaceuticals from them. So even in its current state, before it's verified and so on, I think it's still at this point a good resource for ethnobotanists and ethnopharmacologists.
What could you tell me about some of those medicinal plants that are specifically mentioned in the book?
One that she talks about is what we know as soursop. And she mentions that it was used as an antiparasitic, an antiepileptic, and as an antidote for fish poisoning. An interesting side note is, so the name of it is, you know, we know the fruit, it's really not sour, it's quite sweet, and the
delicious.
Juice, you know, it's delicious.
I'll just mention it's known in Spanish in the region as guanabana, or soursop in English.
And so we know that this thing is sweet, but it's called, you know, it has the name is the opposite. It's called sour sop. And she gives some clues, perhaps, about the nomenclature. So she thinks that the sour sop might be an English approximation of the indigenous name, soursach. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So soursach becomes sour sop for this sweet fruit.
What was your initial reaction when you first saw these drawings of these plants?
So the first time I saw them was when Judith Russell pulled out her iPad and was showing me these pictures that she had taken of the manuscript. She had gone to see it along with Emilio. And they were just beautiful. They looked like they were done by a professional artist. The attention to detail was just exquisite. It just looked like the work of a professional and someone who did it with a lot of care.
What was the coolest thing that you learned about through reporting about this book?
I think for me, the coolest thing maybe wasn't so much about the book itself. I am from Jamaica, and so I was so thrilled that this was something that came from my part of the world, in the Greater Antilles. So I was really excited to work on this.
If someone's listening to this and they might be interested in learning more or possibly seeing this text, where is the book actually located today?
Well, the book is online, so anyone with an internet connection can see it. So Cornell, they digitized it and then made it available through a global digital service called the Hathi Trust. And so you can probably just Google Hathi. It's H-A-T-H-I, Hathi Trust, and Anne Wollstonecraft's name. Or more easily, they can go to, so I wrote a story in National Geographic for this. They can go to that story. There's a link directly to the Hathi Trust, and they can just look through at their leisure all the drawings and all the, you know, read all the descriptions about the work.
That was Zerny Reed. She's a science writer and a lecturer at the University of Florida College of Medicine. She recently reported on a story for National Geographic about an old botany book that was lost in history. The book was discovered by scientists after 190 years. It has detailed drawings and observations of plants native to Cuba during the 19th century. You can find more details on our social media and read her story by going to WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for Thursday, September 12th. Coming up next week on Sundial, the push is on for the 2020 census. Despite the citizenship question not being included, there are still questions about how the census information will be used and who can participate. We'll speak with Miami-Dade County Commissioner Esteban Bobo. Plus, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas' parent, Andrew Pollack, is out with a new book. His daughter, Meadow Pollack, was killed in the Parkland shooting. He'll join us to discuss his perspective on school safety measures and the actions taken by the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. Finally, we hear from a South Florida astronaut who's trying to get more people involved in the arts. The Global Space Art Project makes its way to Miami for a special exhibition. I'm Danny Rivero. Thank you so much for listening. Lewis will be back next week.